Howdy, listeners. Welcome back to Warp Celluloid, your premier podcast for weird movies and far-out flicks. I'm your host, Jack Rourke, with my esteemed co-host,
General Williams. Thank you, Jack. How's it going?
Doing well, doing well. If it is my understanding, you started out your morning with today's movie, right?
I did. I started my day with this movie in time for the recording, so I could have it fresh and a very interesting way to start the day, to say the least.
Interesting is a polite way of putting it, but an interesting film demands an interesting guest to discuss this with. And with that in mind, today's special guest, would you care to introduce yourself?
Hello, I am Savedro, and I'm some random weirdo that they pulled me in off the street to talk about this graphic and bloody film. I'm happy to be here today.
Oh, come on, you're more than just a rando.
I am a documentary filmmaker. My main emphasis is the X rating, the adults only rating. So whether that be the more sexually explicit, the more graphically violent, anything that pushes the envelope is extraordinarily controversial, and the kind of the best era for those type of films is the 1970s, and this film in particular came out in 1973, so it's like the exact perfect year for this type of film. So this is a great time period to study. There is no other time period like it. And it's even more insane that it's now more than 50 years since this point. So I'm always excited to look at this period of history.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive into it.
All right, without further ado, today's film is Flesh for Frankenstein, also known as
Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, rated X is here.
Walt Disney's turning in his grave.
Newsweek magazine says Andy Warhol's Frankenstein is a perversely fascinating movie.
Very bloody.
Gory. It was a trip.
Playboy says swooping bats, severed limbs, human entrails, a hideous decapitating gadget, and some well-turned breasts and buttocks are among the treats that slither off the screen.
Yeah, I think it's a type of movie I've never seen before.
Sickening.
I think it was an excellent film.
Judith Crist in New York Magazine says Andy Warhol's Frankenstein has some very funny things going for it.
If you like Andy Warhol, you like Frankenstein, you like X-rated movies, you like it's freaky movie. It's a really freaky movie.
Andy Warhol's Frankenstein from Bryanston Pictures, rated X, under 17 not admitted.
So, gentlemen, was this your first time with this movie?
This was my first time with this movie. I knew a little bit about it from Jackie telling me about it, but other than that, you know, going in pretty blind, I'm honestly not super accustomed to the X-rated, I guess, subgenre, I would even say. But yeah, this was a ride.
As for you, Savedro?
I have seen it before, but it had been a while. For probably a decade, I haven't seen it. You know, a lot of Warhol's films are Warhol adjacent. This is one that he had like the least amount to do with. It was kind of like an executive producer position, what you would call it today. Like, it was his name helped it more than anything. And a lot of his other films that he was attached to, they were experimental. And since there was nothing else like them at the time, you know, they were parts good and parts bad. And so he was instrumental in kind of bringing sexual explicitness into more mainstream cinema. About 5 years prior to this, he had created a film called Blue Movie. And that one very famously is kind of known as the first time that sexually explicit content was widely distributed. And you know, not long after that, within a month or two, is when Mona, which is often considered the first widespread theatrically distributed pornographic film, comes out. And so this was a very provocative time. These films aren't necessarily good, but this film in particular, like those films prior to this one, weren't very good. They were trying so many different things. So that's why you get... but there was no films like that. So that's why you get experimental stuff like Andy Warhol filming someone getting a blowjob. And it's just their expression...
Or Lou Reed drinking a Coke.
Yeah, you know, it's just... There was nothing like that at the time, so when you're experimenting with the genre, you get a lot of crazy shit like that. And this film in particular represents kind of like the best possible situation, because you have the gothic subgenre, which I think lends itself to both the violence and the sexual aspects. And then you also have, you know, the right cross-section of history, because you have people that are more free sexually. You also have the Vietnam War, which is happening in the background. So violence is very much in the forefront of people's purview. So seeing more graphically violent content and the sexual content at the same time, this was very daring and provocative. And the juxtaposition of these two things at the right time, it's just perfect. Again, if you look from 1973, like 1972, 1973 to 1979, that's the real era of sex and violence being combined on screen. And this is a type of film that, you know, is so daring with its cross-section of sex and violence that you can't help but look at it as something that inspired people like Cronenberg. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. It's this is a very provocative work that has been attempted to be replicated over and over again throughout the years.
It's funny you mention Cronenberg, because my experience with this movie is largely hearing about it is this is a lot of filmmakers' favorite titles. It, funny enough, kind of like the Velvet Underground, that quote, right, of no one really bought this band, but everyone who ended up forming bands heard that album. I know Edgar Wright's a huge fan of it, and its sister film Blood for Dracula. I know Nicholas Refn is definitely a fan of this, and in fact, I have a quote from him from his Criterion Top 10 about the film. Flesh for Frankenstein is the only film I ever wish I made. Honestly, makes so much sense knowing the rest of his filmography. If I'm not mistaken, he put out a compilation album as a promotion for The Neon Demon called The Wicked Die Young, mostly just a collection of stuff that he was playing on set, including a Claudio Ghisi score cue from this movie.
Nice.
So, Flesh for Frankenstein is very much in his DNA, and it's brought, I think, not just important in the history of the NC-17 rating, but also in the history of horror comedy, because this is a confluence of multiple things, not just cultural. Morrissey was hired... honestly, at, I believe, Polanski's suggestion as he was filming either Macbeth or What at the time. So, which one of the two was using the Todd AO system, which was an early thing for 3D, which we will definitely get back to later. And he's like, hey, how about we get Morrissey to do it? I know he's cool with Warhol, and he would definitely turn something cool, and that got the talks rolling. Warhol ended up dipping out. The stories are conflicting from what I could tell. Some say he was taking time off to recover from an assassination attempt, while Morrissey has a more, shall we say, bitter outlook at it. I watched some of those extras on the Vinegro Syndrome disc. He really seems burned by the whole experience.
Who had an assassination attempt on him? Morrissey or...
Warhol was the one.
Excuse me. Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's even a...
It's worth noting that Morrissey was like, he just showed up at the after parties in front of the bill. He was more involved with Blood for Dracula, though.
There's a movie about the Warhol assassination attempt called I Shot Andy Warhol. And I think there was a book about it, too.
Mary Harron, right? Same director as American Psycho?
Nice.
Yeah. And then, what's-her-face? Guinevere Turner wrote the screenplay. And they're longtime collaborators. They also made that Betty Page bio and... Mary Harron, of course, directed American Psycho, and then Guinevere Turner shows up in the film. I think she co-wrote the script too. So, but yeah,
nice. I think the reason I wanted to do this on the show, because I saw this a couple years ago, fresh out of college, in between jobs, so a lot of time to catch up on movies. I'm like, what the hell is this thing? I watch it, and I'm like, I like that you say there really is nothing else like it, because I cannot think of a single film, besides Blood for Dracula, that this thoroughly tries to marry legitimate class critique. An angry, reactionary look at social mores, satirization and indulgence of extreme sex and violence on top of just the most gimmicky of camera moves. Like, I think it's a very well-composed movie in the whole. The scope helps it look nice, but the thing I noticed on the second watch with the 3D is that it really helps the effects pop. Like that Carlo Rambaldi head that they do when they decapitate the wrong guy for the monster. It really leaves an imprint as something funny, but also I don't find it a scary movie, but it makes me squirm looking at it.
Yeah, the effects were pretty astonishing, honestly. I mean, this is not a film that I would typically watch myself, which is why I love doing this podcast so much. And Jack, this feels very much up your alley in the best way, with the most respect. But yeah, I had a great time with it. I don't know. It's still a lot to take in. I was impressed by the effects. I thought the story, there was a nice critique of class, as you mentioned. But yeah, I'm learning a lot from you guys. So
yeah. It's especially funny that the class angle shows up, because it's even stronger in Blood for Dracula, where we literally have a shot of a naked Joe D'Alessandro standing against a wall like a Boris Vallejo poster with a red hammer and sickle spray painted behind him. And, like, it's funny how bizarrely unsubtle it is. It's a weird flux of things. None of this together should work, and yet it leaves an undeniable imprint.
Yes. And I think that the 1970s in particular, you know, going back to what I was saying before, just a great time for this, because the reason why this film does work is because every aspect of it is willing to be so daring. It's willing to go and push the envelopes. And I think that when you do that, these films kind of exist in their own genre. They are no longer... They can't really be considered comedy. They can't be considered erotica. They're just adult cinema because they have all of these themes at once. You know, there's parts of it that are very serious. There's parts that are a little, they're over dramatic or they're melodramatic. There's parts that are over the top. There's parts that are just as serious as any drama film. And because of that, because you do have these wide range of emotions and everything like that, I love that sort of film that is willing to tackle these different ideas and themes and not shy away from things. Something that I find very interesting is that for being X-rated, the violence goes harder than the sexual content does. And the sexual content is, it's elegant. It's elegant pornography, I guess you would say. It never goes, to the point where it's explicit. And so even though this is the era of, being explicit, and they could have very well have gotten away with anything that they wanted, attention to make it more decadent, and to make it more beautiful, and to focus on more the erotic elements, rather than the more, I guess, exploitative. This could have very well have just been, you know, another blowjob movie. Like, they could have actually just shown people actually having sex on screen. This was the era to do that. This year in particular is the same year as Deep Throat and Behind the Green Door and The Devil and Miss Jones. You know, all of those films are in the top 10 of the box office that year. Literally, pornographic X-rated films are in the top 10 of the box office of the year. And so this film could have very well have gone farther, and yet it has a certain amount of restraint. And because it has that restraint while being so bonkers, I have no choice but to respect it. The, you know what I mean? Like it knows when to be more intense. It knows to save the more provocative, violent moments for just the right time. It knows that when, you know, when the door gets closed on Udo Kier, that it has to hold on the hand for a really long time and, like, you know, it go on and on and on and really show his emotion. And because you're able to show something that graphic on the screen for so long, it becomes a different dramatic scene than what we're used to. We're used to someone only playing with, you know, a certain let's say a certain crayon in the box. But now they're able to draw with a different crayon. They're able to be more provocative and in some ways bring about a new level of emotion because now they have this graphic violence to add upon it. And so Udo Kier in this movie in particular is fascinating because he is so melodramatic that it circles around back to being a good performance, if that makes any sense. Like
it absolutely makes sense.
Yeah, he is so into this role and he is so completely insane that it goes beyond being campy anymore, and it comes back to being like, yeah, okay, this is Frankenstein. Like, I believe it.
And when you have a movie that is, in what I can genuinely, or generously rather, call accent soup, pushing yourself to those limits is kind of a necessary thing, because when you have a hammy British sister wife, which, oh God, we're going to get into that later, an equally German assistant, a Boston area stable boy who ends up becoming the film's, I guess, protagonist? Is at a certain point, like, it's a lot of different things. You have to hold your own there, and I think this, among so many other things, is really indicative of his status as a horror icon, because he's a guy who just demands your look with the bug eyes and the slick black hair. You can't take your eyes off it. Him in this, and I think it's to Morrissey's credit that even when these aren't like traditionally good performances in terms of convincing line delivery, you definitely remember it. And the thing I remember him stating in the interviews was he always had an eye for interesting faces, and for a movie like this, that counts.
Yeah, on the point of the accents, at first it kind of bugged me that they were so inconsistent. But then, as the film went on, I really enjoyed it and thought it was kind of funny. Like there's a Boston, Southie, in the European country on this farm, and I'm cool with it now. So I don't know. I thought that was funny, and yeah, in a way that, like, there's so much other stuff going on in this film that is so out there and explicit and wild, and everyone's being so over the top that it just fit right on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, the absurdity helps it, if anything. The lack of explanation for a lot of this stuff, if anything, it just helps it. Because you're not focused on, like, the shoe leather, I guess you would call it, all the parts in between. You're focused on the absurd situations that, you know, the characters themselves are in. So you're able to kind of allow it to be more, the film itself to be more dreamlike. And, you know what I mean? And kind of fill in the information yourself. And there's not a lot of films that I think can get away with something like that. And it's because I think everybody in this movie is kind of so absurd. They're kind of like caricatures.
This movie does something incredibly rare. So rare that I think it might be the only example I can legitimately list, where it is the one time I have ever seen someone go for camp ironically and actually pull it off. Because if you're doing... Because I hate the general so bad it's good movie phase of modern internet culture, or where every jackass with a webcam and a mic thinks they're MST3K, because it's just instantly, let's look for the lowest hanging fruit, let's look for, like, the obvious things, that doesn't work. In my head, I'm just thinking, who the fuck cares when everything else around this is so much more interesting? It ignores genuine intent behind the material, and it also ignores why this stuff is actually funny. But in this case, working from a place of, hey, let's just kind of make fun of this, ends up working out in its favor because the humor hedges its bets, and it helps sell the craziness And it's like the bit I was talking about earlier where they decapitate the wrong guy for the head of the male monster. Part of the reason I find myself laughing is just how brightly white the eyes are and like how much blood is still spilling out of the head like 15, 20 seconds after it's been removed and the body just like twitching with its arms out. Like they go full hog with it. It's not just, oh, he falls over dead. It's, we are going to linger on this for minutes on end and there's not a thing you can do about it. You got to be in for the ride or you're not. And I think it's worth talking about with divisive, truly odd, like, fringe stuff like this.
Something that I love in particular about, you know, again, just holding on that blood for so long is because you have to show that, you know, Udo Kier's character and, you know, and his German assistant are completely insane. And the only way for you to show that they have no care and concern for anybody else's rights, and that they do in fact they are so far gone about and so dedicated to the idea of creating a new race of people for themselves to control, that even the sight of seeing someone's blood spraying out of their head like a ketchup bottle does absolutely nothing for them morally. So. It's a level of camp that is actually also character development. And it goes towards adding to the texture of the overall story. And again, in lesser hands, that could have easily have just been something absurd. But instead, it comes off as, like, these people are really far gone. That they're not even reacting emotionally to something that absurd.
Not only far gone, but conceited and completely full of themselves. Like, how it opens with him, like, I'm going to create my new master race of people. They're going to be so perfect. And every little thing just goes wrong casually over the course of it. Like, no, we're still superior. You're like, it almost becomes like a Daffy Duck cartoon where he just keeps, like, planting into walls and, like, steamrolling ahead anyway. Whereas it's just really funny how they're both completely sociopathic and detached from other people. They are, which both feeds into their attitudes towards their creation and their attitudes towards human sexuality in general. Well, like, I think there is a real talk to be had about this movie in regards to sex as a commodity. Like, the increasing way that we just warp body standards and like, things just progressively getting weirder and just impossible to live up to over time. And I find it interesting because Morrissey is, unlike the rest of the Warhol factory, a social conservative. This is a movie coming from a reactionary place of, what is it with these damn hippies fucking all the time? Don't you see this is weird? But in the process of trying to speak out against that, it ends up saying something different in the process. Instead of, like, won't you kids stop being so promiscuous, instead it becomes, the upper class gets so obsessed with suppressing all of this that they end up getting even weirder and more perverted as time goes on.
Well, and, you know, that's actually a perfect representation for even stuff that we see to this day. If you can go 5 seconds on Twitter, you'll see someone that's like, oh my God, this is so sick. And what they're sharing something that they themselves are commenting on is sick. So they're part of the very issue. And so, you know, that's a very witty classist statement that the very people that are claimed to be in control or claimed to be the most knowledgeable of what is best for society are in fact the ones that pervert it, distort it to a degree where it becomes about something else entirely. It becomes about control. And again, there's not many films that, especially exploitative like this, where those themes and ideas would be able to come across this well.
And I think it hedges its bets from being, right, I know this word gets thrown around a lot, but this could easily, in the hands of a lesser filmmaker, come off as incredibly pretentious and on the nose, but undercutting it with lines like, fuck life and the gallbladder, it creates this weird experience of, I'm thinking right now, but this still delivers as, like, a gory horror comedy in 3D. Like, it's not really a mystery why this became such a huge thing on the Midnight movie circuit. It is the same time as, like, John Waters' films breaking out and developing a reputation.
Yeah, I mean, a line like that, it takes the piss out of it. It's like, if you show Udo Kier humping a woman on screen in the gallbladder, you have to follow it up with an absurd statement like that. Like, yeah, you know, that's literally what I just did. And it, so what you're doing is you're empowering a moment like that by following it with a comedic line. And so you're able to get away with ridiculous instances like that because you're pointing out the absurdity of it. But at the same time, you're being transgressive. So it allows you kind of this latitude. A movie like this allows you a sort of latitude that a serious drama would not. And it's the ability to be fun, the ability to be provocative, and the knowledge that going into this, you're going to see something that is non-traditional. You know, I wouldn't want to watch, you know, if a film is billed as Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, I want to watch a fucked up Frankenstein movie. You know, stuff like that better happen. If it doesn't, then, you know, that's when you get people walking out and, you know, complaining and stuff like that. And this film delivers on that.
Yeah, and I think stuff like that, like, there are a few similar lines to where that does, like, dilate the tone and, you know, leans towards the comedy side. But, yeah, I mean, in a way that's not traditionally funny because there's something grotesque going on, which I think is fascinating. There's a fascinating dichotomy, and I'm honestly not as accustomed or familiar with the horror comedy genre. And it seemed like a great study for that. Because even in the instance where they, you know, cut off the wrong head in the beginning, there was something absurdly kind of funny about that because we knew that they were making a mistake. And there was something so over the top about, yeah, the effects and the dramatization of the scenario that, I don't know, it was just funny.
I think it also helps, right, to grant it credibility that this was one of those, right, overseas productions, and like co-productions, and rather where there's a million different people putting financing, which means a lot of weird rules, that hence why Joe D'Alessandro is like the only American actor in the thing because of a weird financing clause with the Italian side of things. That gets into a whole different thing about dubbing, but bring it full circle. It also means you get, while acting in a way that is very stilted and at first off-putting, you get these gorgeous set design with like very slow, like long takes. And by the way, that's why they ultimately hired Morrissey for the gig, was because he can shoot long takes. It's better for the 3D. He's good with depth of focus. So even if we don't end up screening it like that, it's still going to look pretty handsome and give the thing a greater, I don't want to say joie de vivre, but it brings it an allure. Right, beyond the just, hey, you want to see some tits and a severed head pop out of the screen.
Yeah, there was a dignified and composed style to the film, which I really appreciated. And I feel like also contrasted with the, you know, pulpy actions and lines going on that made it like a very unique, a culmination of varying styles that created something new.
Well, sort of like the best comedies. You know, John C. Reilly once said that the reason why a lot of comedies work is because they have to work dramatically. And if you believe in these characters, if you you're willing to overlook a lot of the absurdities of the situation. And Udo Kier and Otto, everybody in this movie, you're willing to look past the absurdities of the situation because you believe what they're doing dramatically. And so anything that comes off comedically is just like the extra icing. But
it's the gravy. Camp doesn't work if you don't play it straight. Like, no, no winking, no nudges. Like, no, we're actually doing this. Whether you laugh or not, that's up to you. I can't lie, I was full on expecting Chandler to hate this going in, because this is one of those, like, acquired taste, like, really niche titles that could really go either way, depending on who you show it to, but like it or hate it, you're not gonna forget some of the shit you see in this movie anytime soon.
No, I by no means hated it. Definitely just wasn't my kind of movie. That doesn't mean I can't appreciate it and see the artistic merit all around. I definitely had an interesting time. I enjoyed a lot of it. I thought it was fun and funny, but yeah, you know, this again, this is why I love doing this podcast, man. Jack showing me cool stuff that I wouldn't have watched otherwise, and I love it.
It reminds me of how 2 years ago I found this in the sister film Blood for Dracula on Shudder, and like the second I ran out of both, I'm just sputtering like a wind up. So I'm like, you guys got to see this insane thing that someone put in front of a camera. Oh my god, like this is the kind of thing that gets me buzzing, because it's something that feels new, something that feels itself pulled off with complete confidence. And it's funny how one of the things you keep hearing about movies is how do you expect to please anyone if you can't please yourself creatively. This one is only pleasing yourself creatively and then seeing massive returns completely on accident, because actually, Saavedra, now that we can get into it, would you like to mention who put this film out in America?
You were telling me before that it was Bryanston, and I had no idea. But yeah, I mean, they are pretty well known for, like, you know, X-rated distribution, or, you know, adult cinema distribution. So it's particularly during this era. And, you know, it's notable, as I kind of told you before, that Warhol was instrumental in kind of bringing about X-rated films. And, you know, this is the first of three that, like, definitive ones that he made. So you've already mentioned the sister film of this, Blood of Dracula, or I can't remember, but one of those. But a couple years later, he also released a film in 1977 called Andy Warhol's Bad, and that is a great title for it, because it's not that great of a movie. And that's the last film that he had anything to do with as like a producer. But this is like what I would call it, the one that represents the best confluence of what a X-rated film could be. So you said, Chandler, that this isn't necessarily your type of film, but I will let you know that this is of the best of this type of film that you can see. This represents kind of like the good things that can happen from this type of situation. Most of the time, you do not get a good thing happening. Most of the time, you get, as we were, you know, talking about before, you get the provocation just comes from one element of the story, be it the sex or the graphic violence. There's only one true focus, and this is a film that is focused more on themes and ideas, and interweaving the sex and the violence. And so it's, you know, I would say that this is probably the best film that Warhol had anything to do with. And it kind of makes sense that, you know, his involvement is very, you know, it's kind of shady. Who knows really how much involvement he had with it. And that makes sense. It feels like a film where he had the least amount of, you know, telling people to look at the camera and, you know, break the fourth wall. And it doesn't have a lot of things that he was known for in his type of films. It has the room to be a real movie. And so I know that, you know, it speaks better on his career. It's kind of one of the better things that his career, you know, film wise would have been known for. So if you're going to look into his other work, I wouldn't recommend it, because it's mostly just extremely boring. It's like, you know, in the 50s and 60s, early 70s, it would have been like, wow, there's nothing like this. But now it's like there's 10 million people that are doing the same exact things, you know. There's or a million things that, you know, you can go on Pornhub and see a lot of stuff that he was doing, you know.
Or maybe not in Chandler's case, because currently he's in Texas. So have fun on that journey, my friend.
Well, get a VPN.
Yeah, I've seen you know, a clip or two of Empire, but that's about it for my experience with Warhol's film career. I believe you, man. Like,
there's nothing to really see in Empire. It's literally just 8 hours of the Empire State Building.
One static shot.
I got the idea. Yeah,
look, this is profound. Okay, look, no shit. Like, who the fuck am I compared to Andy Warhol? Who am I, literally? But you know, it is still at the end of the day just a static shot of the fucking New York. You know, the Empire State Building. At the end of the day, we're like, again, you know, it's profound. There's only so much you can extrapolate.
Yeah. I mean, I get his whole avant-garde thing, but, you know, it's, yeah, I had to skip through it. But no, I mean, you were right.
I don't blame you at all.
You're right, and I agree on this being, like, so balanced in not only the sex and violence, but in the themes and motives and characterization of everyone, which I did appreciate and saw it as an actual movie because, I don't know, I watched the trailer and I was expecting something, you know, much worse, if I am going to be honest.
Flesh for Frankenstein.
Andy Warhol's Frankenstein is here. No one under 17 admitted. I miss those spots. By the way, I found a radio spot on the Vinegar Syndrome disc for this, which... first off, can I just say it's really fucking funny that there's a movie out there that has discs from both Criterion and Vinegar Syndrome? Literally, like, the two opposite extensions of the pole. Like, here is the most austere, boutique, bougie possible way of representing classic film. And then the other end is, fuck it, you want to see some trash that's really going to light up your brain?
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I watched this on the Criterion channel, and I was surprised to see the Vinegar Syndrome, you know, buffer at the end.
You know, in some ways, I respect Vinegar Syndrome a little bit more than Criterion in some ways, because I feel like their releases are a little bit better put together. In some regards, it depends on the release, but I think that, you know, attention to detail from Vinegar Syndrome is... I would prefer it in the hands of them than in Criterion. In the hands of Criterion, it seems more like a, this is for us, not for them type of thing. It's like it adds to their catalog. Whereas Vinegar Syndrome, it's like, this is us, guys. Like, this is us. It feels thoroughly within their oeuvre of work that they've released. And you know what I mean? I don't know if that makes
sense. I hear you.
I know that sounds kind of classist, and you know, it brings it all back to what we were, you know, the themes of this.
Yes. What do these vile Philistines want with this Andy Warhol film?
It kind of makes me mad all the time that, like, Criterion is the main distributor of Sallow. It's like, you know what? Fuck you guys. You know, like, you're gonna have that. That Sallow really belongs to a boutique, shitty, like, the shittiest, grossest, nastiest distributor that they could possibly find. Like, it deserves to be. And again, I'm not going to say that I love that movie. I appreciate it for what it is. But the fact that it's on Criterion is so funny. It's like them trying to say, yes, we even love the craziest film of all time. Like, it's, you know what I mean? It seems so much more like for them than for the project itself. But I don't know. I digress. It's
understandable. I still appreciate it, if only because the idea of them going down means a lot of classic film is just going to get lost at any time and basically become unavailable. But there was a tweet and I saw ages ago that more or less came to the conclusion of Criterion has largely been coasting off of a reputation that they developed in the mid-2000s, and I can't really argue against it, really. I mean, they still put out cool stuff occasionally, but you do notice the extras do get kind of slim as time goes on. But this, I would not have expected a bizarre anti-comedy horror film with, like, austere... mindful things in the periphery be something put out on the same level that the label that put out Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers, with the amount of, like, restoration and, like, detailed research that someone puts into, say, Apocalypse Now or The Deer Hunter or something with, like, an actual reputation in the or into the broader public consciousness. And I, it's mean, really I cool.
But we'll take like the film, that. Yeah. You know, I'm researching right now is Tarzan: Shame of the Jungle, and I did 10 hours worth of interviews with the director, Jean-Paul Levens, and he's known more affectionately as Pisha. But you know, his work isn't really well known in America. It hasn't had a wide release. It hasn't had an American release since 1984. Any of his movies in America since 1984. And on paper, you could look at this film, his first movie, Tarzan, and say, okay, this is a piece of shit. You know, why would anybody want to ever, you know, do anything for this movie? But at the same time, it's like there's a story there. There's so much there. And, you know, all of these films are worthy of attention. But that's kind of the problem is that, you know, it's the fight to get the right kind of attention. Because obviously, you know, a film like this, you know, you want to have it be taken seriously, but you also want to look at it as a piece of camp. So it's a rare situation. And adult films in general are in a rare situation where people, they're afraid to say that they like it without calling it camp. But they also don't want to say that they hate it. But this is also, you know, it's not a film for everybody. So it's a difficult situation. You know, it's you want to be on both sides. You want to give it the credibility that it has as a great piece of work. But you also have to say, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this is also just a gory exploitative version of Frankenstein. Like, so it's like it's yeah, you don't get that often.
And weirdly enough, I find it, not just interesting on the levels of class and like sexual commodification. And just the general changing mores of the time. As an adaptation, this is one of the most bizarre, interesting versions of it, just in terms of approach. Like, there's hints that there's weird shit going on with Frankenstein's family lineage in the Shelley text, but here it's basically just confirmed, like, no, they're married. And I believe it was Udo Kier on the commentary track who said, this man is so wrapped up in his work, and so repulsed by sex as an idea, but fascinated by it at the same time, to where he's like, yeah, she's around, why not, is his rationale for marrying his sister. Which makes sense within the context. It's this movie is just the damnedest thing.
He's completely insane. The moment that really worked for me, though, is that the fact that his creation doesn't want to live. And, you know, that goes back to the original Frankenstein, We Belong Dead. In Bride of Frankenstein, that's one of the most famous lines, you know. And so I liked the subversion and the fact that he commits Harry Carey and, you know, spoiler alert, he tears out his own stitch. Yeah.
It's fine. We're like 40 minutes in. No one's listening. Yeah, he's going to
he tears out spoilers. His own stitches. And I liked that subversion. I liked the idea that they use similar dialogue, and they use, you know, this, and it's the same with kind of another thing that models the prior Frankenstein is the moment where, you know, she invites the creature into her bed and he strangles her, and that reminded me very much of like the scene where he's playing flowers with the little girl and throws her in the lake, you know, in the original Frankenstein. And It seemed like a 20th century subversion of that same style. And so it's like what you're doing is you're referencing, you have reference points of the original work, but you are amplifying them by increasing the stakes. And so what do? You know, this is a more erotic atmosphere. So you invite, you know, the woman and the male together, and you have, you know, him kill her, you know, as opposed to just throwing her in the water. And I think that, you know, the fact that they're willing to increase the stakes while maintaining the truth of the original, I think is probably what makes the whole thing work. You know, the insane level of the doctor who's kind of lost his way and, you know, is the modern Prometheus and wants to test new grounds, but has, you know, completely lost it mentally. You know, it's that's not something that not everybody can do. I don't know if I was rambling there. Sorry.
And I think it's worth singling that out because I mentioned earlier that both he and Otto, his assistant, are just complete buffoons, like egotistical, way too confident in their plan. And it reflects in the end results when it's basically just like a kid on a desk smashing action figures together.
Yeah, they don't even...
together, just expecting them to make, like...
He doesn't even remember.
Like creatures in a zoo.
Yeah, at the end when Otto's just kind of like, you know, fucking up the creations, he doesn't even care anymore. And he's just like... He's just mad that someone came in and smashed his toy airplane. Like, it's just, you know, it's... And I think he has this line about, like, you know, it doesn't even matter if I remember how to do it. It's just the fact that, you know, it was done now. Like, the fact that I have to start all over again. You know, it's... He is kind of like a manically depressed fool. You know, it borders on... It has like that 1930s level of reality where you're like, can this person really do this? And you're like, I guess so. I guess they are intelligent enough to do this. But then the next scene is just like, no, this person is not intelligent enough to do this. Like, but I think that's what makes it so great, though, because it's like, this is such a flash in the pan situation. You know what I mean? It's just like this guy finally, after years of being insane, finally had a moment of something. Something happened, and then he just completely fucked it up.
It reminds me of what, circling back to something you said earlier, how a lesser version of this would just completely jumble the tone. I mean, what's already a pretty wildly swinging tone, because there is an animating intelligence underneath it. It's not just provocation for shock value, it's provocation with a point underneath it. And I think often the best X-rated and NC-17 films work like that. It's why David Cronenberg's Crash works. It's why Ken Russell's The Devils works, is that there is a broader goal. Like, I actually have a point to make here, and there's no better way of doing it other than to push it to the extreme where no one can really ignore it.
Yeah, it did feel grounded in that sense, which I appreciated about it. And, you know, made it feel more real and, like, need, you know, like it needed to be taken seriously, or at least as serious as you want to invest in it, and it'll meet you there.
But still willing to be silly, you know, and willing to admit the absurdity of the situation. That's it, you know, immediately pulling the piss out as soon as it happens.
I love all the weird shit that you just see Otto looking at, like just those weird, like bug-eyed looks when he gives everything. Just and also following up on the fuck life and the gallbladder line, him attempting to do so literally,
he does,
and then instantly screwing it up. Which, by the way, I'd also like to highlight one of the best 3D shots in the whole movie. Just seeing that spleen out there, like, ugh, perfect kind of like matinee shock response. It's just perfect.
I love the Robert Redford just Jeremiah Johnson stare that he gives after he does the you have to fuck life in the gallbladder. It pauses for a second and he just goes, you know, just like,
thank you very much.
Like, oh, you know, for like foreshadowing, and it's just you know, again, you have to play it with broad strokes like that.
And speaking of weird things, have we gotten to the kids yet? That are just constantly lingering in the background, like Anna Paquin and The Irishman. They're just literally, like, constantly hovering in the background, just staring blank-eyed at what's happening, and then finally culminating with them resuming the doctor's work. It's really funny that this is an Italian co-production, because it reminds me so much of the kids in Giallo films. Just, like, weird, dead-eyed Muppets that just hang around, like, just witnessing what, in other cases, would be the most traumatic fucking thing you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, they, like...
It's so bizarre.
No, I was just gonna say, yeah, I mean, that reminds me of, like, is it Children of the Damned, I think, came out?
Yeah.
And that's all, or something like that. There's just like a number of films of just like dead-eyed children, you know, that are, this was the era for that. And the fact that they never say anything, and, you know, that ending is, it's shocking. It's unexpected. you expect them to kind of lower Joe D'Alessandro at the end. And the fact that that there's no explanation, it just ends. Freeze frame ends. I love that. I don't need an explanation. I don't need an extra scene. I don't need the stinger. I don't need the follow-up. I don't need a sequel. I need to be wrecked emotionally and still be thinking. And that's something that's desperately lost from the theater. Everything needs to be resolved now. You know, everybody wants the 29, and it's because we've been fucked in the mouth by people like Peter Jackson for so long, who have just given us so much extra content of extra lore and shit that doesn't even fucking matter anymore, and we've been spoiled rotten in every aspect. So we just, everything needs to be tied up in a bow. We can't have anything that's like esoteric or left on like a more provocative ending. You know, it's, I wish that we could have more movies like this that were more ambiguous, where you don't know.
I just like that it ends with that implication, to be honest, because you basically can fill in the blanks from there. Like, oh, they're going to make Joe D'Alessandro their new play toy with whatever they're going to slice and dice him up with. It's just, it establishes the outlook. It's the all you need sometimes is just that little implication that, no, things aren't going to get better. It's only going to get strength. Ranger, it really informs the rest of it, and ironically, leaving it open-ended actually helps bring it around full circle a lot more effectively on the thematic level.
Yeah, the cycle of this idea and how it can't be broken, and that ultimately each generation is going to think that they're doing God's work, when in reality it's just about control and manipulation.
And it's funny because every shot of them basically gives off the Helen Lovejoy, won't somebody think of the children vibe.
Or
also,
or like it's weird.
I guess the modern way to...
The way that I looked at it is like they almost have like a hidden... They know what's going to happen. That final scene is almost like the confirmation of them being in control almost the entire time. Because... If you look in previously in the film, I believe it was the children that, you know, kind of led multiple people to the laboratory and stuff like that. So they've been almost like these hidden little masterminds the whole time.
The movie opens with them putting a doll in a guillotine and then decapitating.
So it's like, it really is about like this cycle of the next generation.
Yeah.
Always thinking that they're a step ahead when in fact there's an unforeseeable force that is far stronger than anybody else in the main story. And I think that that's more terrifying than anything that, Udo Kier does in the film, because it shows that there's a force that's more powerful, that is not only learning from him, but has the ability to supersede anything that he has done. You know, the next generation.
Hubris bleeds and repopulates over time. Right, it's a, I think, quite frankly, brilliant expanding of the novel's text of what it's the just the creation of this thing of you're bringing dead tissue back to life. Like, if that's possible, that's not a genie you can put back in the bottle. It's the kind of thing with implications that are only going to get worse in strength and really make us question, like, what's left of us if this is what we're willing to do to push the boundaries and play God.
Yeah, and I mean, just on a stylistic level, I love the final shot, just that pull out with the rising score. I feel like that
the Claudio Gizzi music is so good in this.
Yeah, I feel like that grounded me in the situation, and it, I don't know, made me take it a little more serious in a way that I thought was appropriate for the ending. Yeah, the kids were just creepy the whole time. They're just like watching their parents have sex with other people, and I don't know,
and each other, which I have to imagine is the kind of thing that just brings about, like, okay, you're gonna need therapy in about 18 years. Okay, lots of therapy.
But they seem so crazy from the beginning too. Like, they don't say a word, they don't change their facial expression, or seem like reactionary to anything, which I thought was just
genius direction.
Just kind of funny.
I'd like to harp on the Geezy music just for a little bit longer, because I find it interesting how much of this movie's shifting tone can be just embodied in that score. Because there's moments of it that are legitimately really unnerving, very atmospheric, and then it just, those soft piano interludes, and it suddenly becomes like a soap opera. It reminds me a lot of Pino Donaggio's work for Brian De Palma. Has that like lush, lurid, like the, it gives a loftiness but also a greater melancholy to what's playing out in front of your
it
eyes.
It really does play a, it has a huge debt to like the films of Douglas Sirk. And another person that was like very inspired by Douglas Sirk was Pedro Almodovar. If you watched, The Skin That I Live In, the Almodovar film from 2011 with Antonio Banderas. This is a very similar film. It plays on similar. It's his version of Frankenstein, and this sort of film, these types of filmmakers, they don't really exist anymore. You know, people willing to, I guess, desecrate ideas of, you know, class systems and desecration of the body. The only person really doing stuff like that anymore is David Cronenberg. The nearest equivalent to something like this we would have is like, his most recent film. But like,
Crimes of the Future.
Yeah. Other than that, it's like no one else is really doing works like this anymore.
Right. It is ultimately just that mixture of craft, consciousness, and just the willing to do whatever's necessary to get that reaction out of people. Right, it makes something special. It makes something that's really impossible to put into a box neatly. Is it academic? Is it pornographic? Is it funny? Is it creepy? Is it weird? It's all of these things and none of them at the same time. It's a truly baffling capsule of a thing. Funny enough, we're going to be covering this in a few weeks with one of our old college buddies, but you've mentioned Cronenberg a bunch of times. Even with the obvious comparison of Crash sharing the same rating as this, the one that I think of is Naked Lunch with Peter Weller, as it's a movie that also feels like this strange and inscrutable experiment, that can't really be repeated. It's this beautiful one-and-done thing, and I'm so happy it exists. It's just, man, nothing else like it.
Yeah.
Smedra, thank you for being on the show. This was an absolute blast to record.
I'm glad.
Yeah, dude,
thanks for being on. If you knew, I'm not going to share everything, but if you knew what was going on in my life, you would be like, oh my God, take a break or something. It's just, so much has happened in the last month. It is completely insane. Can't even believe I'm still alive. It's been like a never-ending mess of problems, and I'm only recently starting to get away from it. So luckily I'm trying to get back. I have tons of content. I have an abundance of interviews and material and stuff that I want to share with everybody, but I just have not been me. I have not felt like me. And that happens sometimes, you know. It's like I lack the motivation. I've got shit that is going to blow a lot of people's minds, and I want to get it out there, but it's just like, if I don't have the energy and the creativity to put it out there, I'm not going to. It would suck, you know what I mean? And I don't want anything that sucks. And some of my stuff has sucked.
You want to strive for perfection.
Yeah, you know, as much as...
Or at least the closest thing to it.
As much as I can, you know. You know, I'm not perfect in the slightest. But I am the person that cares the most about the subject. And that's the one.
If I'm not mistaken, you have a documentary coming. Yes.
Hopefully, you know, at some point it'll be coming out. I have 15 people that have been interviewed for it so far. It's called Aberration History of the NC-17. I actually have multiple projects at once. The documentary is the main big project. If you want to find out more about it, you can follow me on YouTube at Sites Obscene, which is the name of our documentary web series. And the web series is something that we created in order to tell smaller aspects of the rating system. And when I first began the series, I did not anticipate that it was going to get as big as it was. Literally within a couple of episodes, I got to talk to Joe Dante.
Nice.
And, you know, find lost footage from Gremlins. And then since then, I've been able to talk to a lot of different people. And the project has gotten way bigger than I ever anticipated. Unfortunately, I'm one of the only people involved with it. I don't have enough people involved. And so even though I have completely never before seen footage and history and documentation and interviews and all that stuff about tons of things, I don't have the man hours because I have a full time job. You know, I'm lucky that I get to work from home, but I don't have as much energy and ability as I want to and need to. If I had like a full team and stuff like that behind me, I'd be able to focus a little bit more. But instead, I have to have like days where I just focus on research. And for probably 6 weeks now, I haven't felt like editing because the research has just been that good. When you're looking at the shit that I'm looking at, it's hard for you to look at iMovie and be like, yeah, I'm gonna make a new
video. It's a spoil of riches. Like, you don't want to cut anything.
You don't
or anything because like, oh, this is too good. People need to see it.
No, you don't want to stop. I found a lost Bill Murray recording recently.
Oh, damn.
You know what I mean? I have a minute and a half of never before heard Bill Murray ever. You know, at least not heard since like 1978.
Nice.
I have that in my possession. I have never before seen stories about John Belushi, and you know, it's insane. When you're looking at this stuff, you don't, like you just said, you don't want to walk away. You don't want to be like, oh, you know, I'm going to get back on YouTube. Like, no, fuck that. You want to stay you want to be like Gollum, and that kind of, it turns you into Gollum. Cause you're like, oh my God, there's nobody on earth. You know, like you get obsessed with the idea, but it's just, it's a process.
Yeah, man. Well, congrats on the project. That sounds awesome.
I can't wait to see it. Yeah. It's funny you said get back, because it would be really funny if this was that length of just the, like, here is all the footage. It's a truly, it's weird to me that you say it's incompetent, because I just look at the scale and the ambition of what you're doing, and I'm just sitting there like a little bit in awe, if I'm being honest, because it takes that kind of dedication and knowledge and intuition, and projects like this do not neatly fit into schedules. They take years. They take careful cunning and planning and stitching together. And the fact that you are this open on this show about that, it's really commendable. It shows you got your head in the game.
I have an episode planned with Lloyd Kaufman from Troma. And then I have another episode that's coming up about the history of adult animation. So it is a very exciting time. And, you know, it's also a difficult time for everybody, because it's hard to do this. I mostly do this on my own. I have a research assistant, Sarah, who helps me with everything, but I do a lot of this on my own, so it does take me time. But I am very excited. I'm very passionate about the work that I do. I'm very happy to answer any questions that people have about censorship history. And I hope that I get to be on the show again. So thank you guys so much for having me. And I will see you all in the future. Bye-bye.
Next week, Chandler's Got Selection and is going to be another pool end of the Richard Linklater Rotoscope Experimentation Pool. As always, you can find us on Letterboxd in the links in the description, socials at Warp Celluloid. Saavedro, Chandler, thank you guys so much for joining. This has been an absolute blast of a conversation.
Thanks, Jack.
Until then, take care, listeners. Signing off.
To know death, Otto, you have to fuck life in the gallbladder.